Hello and welcome back to Film Weekly with me, Jason Solomons.
One, two, ready, go!
This week, I talked to John Hurt about his role in Jim Jarmusch's highbrow hitman thriller, The Limits of Control. And at last, the squeaky clean reissue of Powell and Pressburger's The Red Shoes hits the big screens. I'll be talking to Michael Brook, curator of the BFI's Screen Online, about this very British cinematic gem. Zan Brooks is back to help me review some of the week's releases, including Spike Jonze's larger-than-life adaptation of Maurice Sendak's Where the Wild Things Are. Yes, it's the fluffy, fluffy monster sound of Film Weekly.
Would one still call those Bohemians? My grandfather was Bohemian. You know, in the Prague sense. I strongly doubt that he would have had any bloody sympathy for those kinds of Bohemians. But then, of course, they are often the true artists, are they not?
The unmistakable voice of British actor John Hurt there in his enigmatic cameo in The Limits of Control. Hurt's expansive vocal capacity, alongside the fact that he possesses a face that resonates the full spectrum of emotions with just one glance, has ensured that regardless of how long he's seen or heard on screen, his is always a performance of note. So too with Jim Jarmusch's The Limits of Control. His role is the arch guitar man, and to tell us more about the role and why he took it, I'm glad to say we got the pleasure of having John Hurt on the line. John, welcome to Film Weekly. What a pleasure to have you on. How lovely also to see you in as one of the cameos in Jim Jarmusch's film. Did you know what your part was and how you were going to be used and what the film was about when you got involved?
Good heavens, no. No. You never know with Jim what it's going to be. I got to know Jim when I did Dead Man. Now, why he asked for me to be in Dead Man, I'm not quite sure. I think I'm very fortunate. He likes what I do, so, and that's the way Jim seems to work. And when you get the opportunity to work with him, you don't say, what's the part, or what's the film, even. You just say, where do we meet?
This was presumably Seville, he said.
And
the answer
then he said, well, John, it's going to be Sevilla. So I said, oh, that sounds all right, Jim. He said, oh, yeah, it's great. It's great. You want to do this film? And I said, of course I do, you know. no question.
That reminds me of the old Michael Caine story about when he got the script. He used to get scripts and he opened it and the first one said, French Riviera exterior day. And he said, yeah, I'm in.
Yeah, there's a catch, though. He didn't have Jim Jarmusch attached.
No, he didn't. He might have thought again.
And I think Jim makes marvellously interesting films. And I think Limits of Control is fantastically interesting. It's a kind of film that if you have to sit and watch it.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, I have to say that in the frenetic world of modern film, to have the space and time to think that the film allows you was a real
pleasure.
Well, what
it does is something quite extraordinary because you watch it. One, it's shot fantastically.
It's Christopher Doyle.
Genius. Yes. And the two of them, I mean, terribly funny. Chris Doyle is rushing around doing this, doing that, doing the other, getting this tremendously sort of frantic fellow. And then you got the sort of the tall man with the big white hair, you know. And well, I don't know what I just do what I'm told here. I just let him do this and let him do that. And anyway, we'll get to doing the scene in a minute or two, John. I think. Yeah. So it's all very droll, you know.
that permeates, that kind of stance permeates the film, doesn't it? I mean, all his films really are so laid back.
Yes, this one is. Is a real watcher.
When you work with him on Dead Man with Johnny Depp, yeah. Quite a few years ago.
I watched
now.
Him work extensively when I was there, I have to say.
Because it was intense. I remember when you got that part and you were in that film, it was quite a surprise. I was like, what's John Hurt doing in this movie?
Well, it was quite a surprise to me, too. But Jim tends to work with people that he likes. Mm. And it's a club I'm very happy to be part of.
Yes, I mean, you've worked with so many directors, John. What's working with Jim Jarmusch like? It sounds like he's sort of singular approach to the way he works. You found that chimes with the way you work, or you just bring, you know, you do your job and they do theirs, and it's up to you as an actor to kind of respond to what the different directors you.
Not at all. It's not. That's certainly not it. No, I mean, I think with Jim, the reason that one says so blithely, yes, of course, where do I go? It's because there's a definite chemistry when you're working together. it really works. Mm. It's you know that it's going to be an interesting, and maybe quite short. They are tend to be quite brief unless you're doing Isaac part, you know.
Yes.
Isaac de Bonquilla.
Yeah, he must have been wonderful to work opposite as well. To just
he was, yes, he's very, very nice indeed. I like him a lot.
Yes, I do.
Yeah.
I don't know him, but I just love his presence in every sort of scene.
Yeah, in everything he's done.
Yes.
It's very good, isn't it?
Yeah. And when you were sort of there in Seville and you were off doing your thing, it reminded me, of course, of another sort of gunman Spain connection that you have, because you were in Stephen Frears' The Hit, of course.
That unfolded itself as well all the way through. That certainly wasn't understood by the writer, by Peter Prince, when he wrote it.
Because it reminds me of something, you know, as I said, mentioned the John Borman's Point Blank. It reminded me of Antonioni's The Passenger as well, with Jack Nicholson.
Yeah, absolutely.
As well. You're having a great run, John, and the last time we spoke, you were receiving your BFI fellowship, thoroughly deserved, at the London Film Festival
earlier this month.
To see you still kind of doing roles like this, and then 44-inch Chess, and it continuing. It gives us. I think all great pleasure. Probably yourself as well. I'm sure to still be working.
Oh, surely. I mean, that's many times I do it because I love doing it. That's so. There's no reason to retire. And that retiring means that you really want to stop doing something because the time. I don't know. Whatever you feel, I don't know. But I don't. Why would I retire from something which I completely enjoy doing? It as long as I do that, then I'll continue, hopefully, to work.
Is it important for an actor like you to re-establish yourself for a new generation, or is it up to the directors to cast you in films because they like? I mean, I suppose something like the last Indiana Jones did that.
So is the Hellboys, I suppose, too. You know, I mean, you know, I don't know really. One just. I mean, to me, of course, Guillermo del Toro is a young director.
Mm.
So
these whippersnappers.
Most of them are young directors now. that's exciting in itself.
And
I love working with new directors. I've always loved working with people who are making their first film.
Yes, I know you've always supported that. Malcolm Venville, for whom you've done 44-inch Chess.
Yes, the one to avoid, probably, is the second film, particularly if their first film has been adulated.
Right, that's good experience for an actor.
If you look at many people's second film, it's the one to avoid. Third film, fine, because then they got their senses back again.
Right. So yeah. You as an actor obviously got good at sort of working this stuff out. Have you ever wanted to take more control and direct yourself or go behind the camera, produce even?
Oh no, not really. My fun is playing as being someone else, you know.
Yeah,
it's not the same thing. It's not the same talent at all. Some people can do both. Some people have both talents. I think I could direct a film, but I'm not sure that I would. Be one that I would appreciate. I don't know. I mean, I have a lot of theories about film. I love talking film.
Absolutely, that's why I asked, because you're so good on the meaning of film and as.
But that doesn't mean to say that you've got original ideas, you know.
Mm.
I think I might be as slightly of the critic.
Yes, well, you know what they're like, you know.
I know, be careful of that, because they're not really doers, are they?
No, that's right. John, where can we... I'm heartily recommending everyone see Limits of Control this weekend, and then 44-inch Chess is out in the new year. What are you working on, though, at the moment? Are you actually in the middle of filming, or have you just come from somewhere?
Not in the middle. I just finished doing... I finished pottering.
Oh, yes.
Never to potter again.
Oh, so all your work is done there, is it?
All my work is done pottery. Oh. Not that it was a huge amount, but it was very nice.
Well, always a laugh, though, isn't it?
Always a laugh, and very, very nice working with...
David Yates.
David Yates.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, really, really enjoyed working.
Of course, you've watched them all grow up, all of them.
So I hope we work together again.
Oh, lovely!
What I would call an adult film.
Yes, yeah. you've watched Harry grow up, Daniel Radcliffe. My God, he's
well. I sort of have, but I missed all the middle bit because I was in the first one briefly.
Yes, in the shop.
And I'm in the last two briefly.
The same character,
but same character, of course. Yeah. Yes. But the thing is, I feel as though I've been in it because the fans don't forget. You know, and they count Ollivander, which always surprised me. I thought, well, blimey, it's only about a 6-7 minute scene, I think, all told.
Well, John, if in the limits of control and in your brief cameos in the Harry Potter, you've shown that you don't need to be on screen a long time to be remembered, and I think that's a perfectly magnificent skill for an actor.
I think it's probably, yeah, it's probably a very good thing.
Especially as you're getting older. It would be a different film without you, which is, I think, a great compliment to a cameo. Take you away.
Oh, that's really kind of you.
Film will be missing something. So for that, John, and for joining us on Film Weekly, thank you very much, as ever, John Hurt.
Real pleasure.
And The Limits of Control goes on general release here in the UK from Friday the 11th of December. And now to the fabled Film Weekly review section. I'm joined by Zan Brooks, The Guardian's critic at large, to review some of this week's cinema releases. Zan, this week we'll be looking at The Weird World of Where the Wild Things Are, Spike Jonze's adaptation of Morris Sendak's children's book, Jim Jarmusch's philosophical hitman thriller, The Limits of Control, and the re-release of a British treasure, Powell and Pressburger's The Red Shoes. But first, let's look at The Limits of Control, starring Ivorian actor Isaac de Bankole in the central role of the silent assassin on a mysterious mission in the Spanish city of Seville. Zan, is The Limits of Control everything you want from a Jim Jarmusch movie?
On the contrary, I think that this is probably everything that I don't want from a Jim Jarmusch movie. This is a film that I think crystallises all that's annoying about Jim Jarmusch and nothing that makes his work special.
Well, he's a director who's sort of developed his own style so much that it almost becomes a tick, doesn't it? I mean, back in the 80s when indie cinema was kind of all the rage and everyone was at it, I mean, Jarmusch was the sort of godfather of American indie cool. I think films like Down by Law, films like Dead Man, even. They had their own particular kind of zen-like grace. And I think my favourite of that was 1999's Ghost Dog, Way of the Samurai, with Forest Whitaker as the silent hip-hop hooded assassin. And, of course, Isaac de Bankole played the ice cream seller in that, and he's now kind of graduated.
He's graduated to the Forest role, and it's very much a homage to Ghost Dog, and it's also, I guess, a homage to kind of other existential hitman thrillers like Le Samurai, you know, the great 60s film with Alain Delon. But it's more a series of mannerisms than a movie, and it makes me feel very irritated with Jarmusch. I remember there's some great line from Jarmusch where he said ages ago, my movies are made up of the bits that other people would cut out of their movies. And at the time I thought, that's so wonderful, that's so charming, that's what makes him so unique. And now I think, and he's doing it here, and it's actually really insufferable.
Really? Because, I mean, I must say that I can see why people would be sort of annoyed with it, exasperated with it. I mean, it's a movie so laid back that it almost can't be asked to get on with telling its own story. Isaac de Bankole orders two espressos in separate cups each time, but whilst they come thick and black, they don't really seem to give him any caffeine hit of motivation.
Not at all.
Still stumbling around the
streets. He needs them in a bucket.
eight espressos in separate cups, Isaac, because we've got to get on with this story. I must say, just in the frenetic world of modern cinema, the jump cuts, the people, you know, trying to kind of get on with the blockbustering and the shouting. This came to me as a sort of slice of calm. I loved the stillness of it. I loved his suit. I love watching Isaac de Bankole. I don't want him to get a move on. He's a beautiful man. Let me enjoy the grace of his statue-like performance.
Well, it is a film about the style of cinema. And I'm all for films that are stylish and have that calm to them and that stasis and that sort of incredible kind of honed precision of poisonousness that I think that this film does. But I think that there has to be something else behind it as well.
In a way, I'm going to differ with you, because I do think it's about something. It says The Limits of Control, and I think it's about the thought of the mission, and I think it's about someone pondering his role in life and whether this is a noble mission and whether he should get on with the job and how to get on with the job and one's role in life. I found it gave me room to think about what the film was about. And in the end, I did sort of achieve some kind of yogic kind of nirvana with understanding this film.
Well, when you say it that way, I'm sure that that is his intention. But there was no yogic moment of transcendence for me. I think I just stuck in the seat, kind of longing to levitate.
Right, the limits of patience were reached for you there, Zan. Change of pace, let's shift to another dimension, to another world. It's Spike Jonze's new film, his adaptation of Morris Sendak's popular children's story, Where the Wild Things Are, about a boy's escape to a land of magic and monsters.
Carol.
Mm-hmm.
Did you know the sun was gonna die?
What? I never heard that. Oh, come on. That can't happen. I mean, you're the king. Look at me. I'm big. How could guys like us worry about a tiny little thing like the sun? Huh?
That's Carol the Monster there, as voiced by James Gandolfini. Azan, this isn't Monsters, Inc., though, is it?
This is very much not Monsters, Inc. You know, this is based on the Morris Sendak children's book from, I think, like the early 1960s, which is beautifully illustrated and very, very short. It's something like 9 sentences long.
I think it's, yeah, 20, it's almost 25 words, or less, like a pitch almost.
Yeah, so if you're talking about kind of zen and boiling everything down to its little essence, this is that story.
Is this a book you read as a kid yourself?
It is, yeah, and I remember loving it. I remember absolutely loving it. It's a haunting book, and I think it's a explicitly psychoanalytical story where it's about the little boy called Max who journeys to a land of monsters and comes home to find his supper still warm, and I guess it is about the unconscious, and the monsters that he meets are perhaps kind of representations of his unconscious that he has to kind of bring into line by telling them that
he's a king.
You were a
bright kid, you worked all that.
I knew all this at 3. I just understood it back to front. And fortunately, and also unfortunately, Spike Jones understands it as well as my 3-year-old self did. And if there is a problem with this film, it's almost that he understands it so well that it becomes more of a cerebral thesis than it does a film.
Because Spike Jones sort of fills in the gaps that aren't there in the book by necessarily kind of fleshing out into a feature-length drama. So Max sort of has an argument with his mum, played by Catherine Keener, and then he sort of rushes off into the woods and ends up in this kind of magical land, which is a kind of construct of his imagination. There are remnants from the real world that crop up in this magical land as a symbol, really. And then when he gets back to the real world, he finds them there, and he sails away for I don't know how long it is, a year and a day on a sea to get to this place. And then the monsters are there. They're all created by Jim Henson's Creature Workshop. Beautiful kind of Muppet-like creatures.
Wonderful to have that kind of lo-fi design in the age of sort of CGI. I mean, it's perhaps not as lo-fi as it wants us to believe it is, because it's adult actors in hairy costumes, but then with their facial expressions kind of computer generated. And it's kind of curious, and I was trying to work out what these monsters represent. Mm. That in a way, they're kids, they're kind of by turns vicious and vulnerable and they're squabbling, but also they're kind of like a kvetching, depressive, curmudgeonly group of middle-aged men and women as well, which is perhaps a kind of a signpost of the adulthood that Max has got to kind of go towards.
So
himself.
Him as a kid sort of not quite understanding the angst of them, the troubles of the adult world, because he's seeing his mum back at there. She's having a sort of tentative affair with Mark Ruffalo, I'm tempted to call him, but it is Ruffalo only
yes.
In this. So he doesn't quite understand, and that tension is kind of seen in these things. I thought it was terribly, terribly beautiful, I have to say. The photography by Lance Accord, it was shot in Australia, I think, with the kind of beach scenes that are in the sea. I mean, I thought
And he's
it was
a beautiful
gorgeous.
Director. You know, he shoots a lot of it in kind of airy, handheld style. You've got the sun glare on the lens, and it gives it this kind of, you're right, this sort of playful, mercurial quality. Which is utterly bewitching. But the weird thing about it was that I was loving the first 20 minutes where Max is running around at home,
yeah,
getting into a snowball fight, and there's a lovely moment where Catherine Keener, who plays his mum, is working, and he's kind of at her feet pulling at her stocking, and it's just this kind of wonderful intimacy. And it was shaping up to be amazing. But then when it goes to the land of monsters where you think it should really come alive, I started getting a bit bored by it.
Well, there's not a lot to do, is there, for the monster? Once he's there, there's no real plot. I mean, the plot would be to come back, and that's the meta, that the actual story within the story, where the monsters are, where the wild things live, they don't really get up to much. I mean, they start building a few bits and pieces, but there's nothing really going on, and I think that's the problem with the film. It sort of stretches that bit out into feature length, and there isn't really any substance to that plot-wise.
You're right. I think it's a beautiful and an intelligent film, but it's a film that weirdly keeps you at an arm's length.
Lastly, we return to a British classic, which has now had a digital polish placed on its original 1948 print and dances back onto the big screen this week. It is, of course, Michael Powell and Emmerich Pressburger's The Red Shoes. Zan, we'll be talking to Michael Brooks from the BFI soon about the restoration, but is this the film that got you into ballet?
Yes, and I've been twirling ever since. Just like Moira.
Martin Scorsese has overseen the remaking of this, of course, with Thelma Schoonmaker Powell.
He's good on the dance floor as well, Martin.
Marty can move, I tell you. Is this a classic film for you? Did you? I mean, girls grow up loving this film. It's always seemed to me, and I remember seeing it as a kid, being a bit bored by it. I have to say, seeing it again now, in all its glory, it is a beautiful, beautiful piece of work.
It's one of those films. I think I was very fortunate because I came to it quite late. I think I was probably like in my early 20s, maybe, when I saw it, and even then, it's a high bar to get over. If somebody says, you know, it's a film about ballet. But this is, I think, one of the great British films of the last century.
Yeah.
It's possibly my favourite Michael Powell and Emmerich Pressburger film, although I kind of maybe nudge towards A Canterbury Tale. But
interesting
choice. I think that it is utterly ravishing. It, you know, I'm sorry, you're falling into all these kind of dance clichés, but it really never puts a foot wrong.
Xander, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Our thanks as ever to Xan Brooks. To read more of his reviews and interviews from the world of film, go to guardian.co.uk/film.
Voilà, Monsieur de Grasse. Will you sit over there, please? Merci. Mr. Crass, at the piano.
Do you usually have a musical accompaniment to your meals, Mr. Lermontov?
No, Miss Page, I do not. But I'm afraid this is going to be your fate for the next 2 weeks. Mr. Krauss is going to play the Red Shoes music for you at every lunch, tea, and dinner you take until we open.
I see.
Yes. In this way, you should become quite familiar with the music.
Yes, I think I probably shall.
The music is all that matters. Nothing but the music.
One of the joys of the last Cannes Film Festival, for me anyway, was meeting Martin Scorsese to discuss the World Cinema Foundation's restoration of Michael Powell and Emmerich Pressburger's 1948 classic, The Red Shoes. Scorsese's debt to this film and his close relationship with Michael Powell in his later years have led to a wonderful restoration of the film in digital glory. After an international tour of the festivals, the film finally gets its UK release this week. And joining me to gaze at the wonder that is The Red Shoes and shine some light on the story of its making is the BFI's Screen Online curator, Michael Brook. Welcome to Film Weekly, Michael.
Hello.
How lovely to see you. And how lovely to be talking about a film like this. I suppose it's such a pleasure when one has an enthusiasm for a film, and you can see it kind of being restored and talked about and getting sort of national glory all over again.
It is an absolutely extraordinary experience seeing it again. I'm unlike, I suspect, quite a lot of the audience now. I have been lucky enough to see it on the big screen, but this was in a revival in the early 1990s. But this new version is absolutely astounding.
Well, I often think with digital restorations that sometimes they make things too shiny again, but you can't do that with the restoration because the technicolor, the colors really are everything. So to see them kind of spruced up is just a joy.
Yes, and also just the general cleaning up of everything. I mean, there are certain... There are advantages of chemical processes, there are advantages of digital processes, and it's just, I think once the restoration team accepted that it was necessary to make it a largely digital process, they were very, very careful to make sure it still had the look of film.
Take me back, I know you weren't there yourself, to 1948. How was the film received? I mean, I got an original review of it, a slightly sniffy review from Film Bulletin in 1948.
Yes, this was the BFI's monthly Film Bulletin, and it's probably quite typical of the kind of reviews it received. It was treated respectfully. It was a big production. It was clearly a serious production. In fact, I'll read what the MFB said. If this film has a fault, it is perhaps because it's overlong and inclined to drag a little in places.
Critics don't change, you know.
Well, it's fair enough because, I mean, it's 134 minutes. That is a long film by late 1940s standards. I mean, it's, you know, it's average length now.
It is these days. I mean, the reason for its length is, let's be honest, is that they're in the middle of it. There's a sort of 20-minute ballet sequence.
Yes.
I mean, this is like going to see a show. I mean, but it is kind of a highlight of British film.
They were taking a huge risk with that. I think Emmerich Pressburger, the writer, thought it could be no more than 10 minutes. And Michael Powell was more inclined to push it to 20 minutes. I think the final version is about 15, so they compromised on that. But it's still a huge risk because it's... In many cases, it's the creative climax of the film, and it's slap bang in the middle. There's still the rest of the film to go.
Absolutely. I think people could be forgiven for thinking, well, it's going to be finished now, surely. But there is the reaction to it. Because the film, for anyone who hasn't seen it, is about the performance of this piece by Vicky Page, the prima ballerina. But it's also about the making of art, really. It's about the collaborative processes involved in making a film, or making a ballet, or making anything, I suppose.
Yes, absolutely. Powell and Pressburger were very, very keen to highlight this collaborative aspect. They famously and unusually credited their films as written, produced and directed by Michael Powell and Emmerich Pressburger. It's generally known that Pressburger was primarily the writer and Powell was primarily the director. Pressburger did in fact go on to direct a not particularly good film. But yes, they also had this production company called The Archers, which brought together a huge range of talents right across the board. They were lucky enough to be able to pick and choose really the best people they had. And when the Red Shoes went into production, they already had a huge pool of talent to draw on.
Who were their collaborators?
There was Jack Cardiff, the cinematographer, who died earlier this year, sadly.
An absolutely a really lovely man. I've had the pleasure to meet him 3 or 4 times. And I loved his work. I even love Girl on a Motorcycle, the film he made with the Marianne Faithfull on the back of the bike.
Yes, absolutely. No, I've met him as well, and I completely agree with you. Now, he was the cinematographer. He just won the Oscar for Black Narcissus, which is almost certainly the reason he didn't win an Oscar for The Red Shoes. I think they were a bit worried about... I think two British... They gave separate Oscars for Black and White and Colour back then. And in 1947, both of them had been won by British cinematographers. The other was Guy Green for Great Expectations.
Yeah, which
and
is
so
amazing.
I think there was a general feeling that it should not go to a foreigner in 1948. So it's a great shame, because The Red Shoes did win Oscars for the music and for the production design, and it really should have got a hat trick with the cinematographer.
Well, because you look at it now, and it's almost a tour de force of cinematography.
Oh, totally,
kind
yes.
of better than Black yes. Narcissus, which is good.
It's an encyclopedia of what you can do with the camera creatively.
But the ballet is remarkable in it. Isn't
oh, yeah.
It? The dance
yes.
is just beautiful.
Yes.
And it's the cinematic escape. It's an unperformable ballet itself.
That was the intention. He wanted to complete... Because previously, when you shot any kind of dance sequence, the camera it was very conscious of the proscenium arch. It starts off in a sort of stage ballet, and then it just goes off in this really weird sort of Giorgio Giacchirico, sort of Salvador Dali, dream, you know, cubist dreamscape.
Absolutely.
And you also see stuff from her point of view. The sort of dancers suddenly turn into this Anton Walbrook, the sort of impresario Lermontov, suddenly pops up on stage, which clearly didn't happen.
And you would think, well, how do they do that? I mean, they kind of superimposed things, and the technology was probably being pushed to its limits.
There's special effects constantly going on there, even really subtle ones. There's a bit where Leonid Messine sort of comes on and does this sort of Nijinsky-style leap, and Jack Cardiff momentarily speeded up the film going through the camera, so it has the effect of just slowing him down very slightly.
So he just holds
just, just
it
prolongs
a
the leap, yeah.
Well, in the spirit of Copenhagen, when the world explodes, when the ice caps melt, when all that will survive of us is love, I feel the Red Shoes might be part of that too.
Oh, I would hope so, yes.
Yeah. Like Wally, he was watching Hello Dolly, wasn't he? He should be watching the Red Shoes.
Yes.
Reissue Wally and just superimpose Red Shoes over the Hello Dolly, because the dancing's better in Red Shoes.
It would actually be, in fact, it would probably fit Wally slightly better, because it's a completely silent, dialogue-free
thing. Would fall in love with it and regret not having legs so that he can't dance like Moira Shearer. Michael Brook, many thanks for coming in and telling us about the Red Shoes. What a pleasure it is to talk about it.
Not at all.
And if you want to find out more about the Red Shoes, just go to bfi.org.uk. Or...
These are the films that meant so much to us and encouraged us and nourished that generation. And by the way, that generation is being De Palma, Spielberg, Schrader,
Mr. Coppola.
Coppola, yes.
Martin Scorsese and me. If you want to hear us discussing The Red Shoes and his love of British cinema and world cinema in general, it's well worth downloading our Cannes special in May. Francis Ford Coppola's also on there. Just go to guardian.co.uk/filmweekly. And that is all for this week. Do remember to pick up a copy of The Observer this Sunday, not only for Trailer Trash, but for My Runners and Riders, for this year's Oscar race being revealed in there. The music featured on the podcast this week was from the very beautiful and wistful soundtrack to Where the Wild Things Are, music by Arcade Fire and Karen O and the Kids. Oh yeah, we're down with them. But for now, from me, Jason Solomons, and my Film Weekly producer, Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.